From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. Subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. Now, if you made a donation this week, please let me say a very sincere thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Please know that our thoughts and prayers are with the people in North Carolina and South Carolina. We've seen a great tragedy. We are seeing compassion played out in that area. Keep them in your thoughts and prayers, if you would. Here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
Well, nearly 5 million public school children across the state of Texas may soon be reading what some call revisionist history.
Moses was central to the founding of the United States. Hillary Clinton and Helen Keller are marginal figures in our history. Ted Cruz's father shot JFK. Now, only one of those claims is not a part of attempts to inject a certain ideology into Texas textbooks in recent years. And we'll find out which one when I'm joined by Dan Quinn of the Texas Freedom Network, which has launched the hashtag Teach the Truth campaign as a response.
Muslims want to learn from Baptists because we are stepping in their shoes. Your people gave sacrifices. Your people had a vision. Your people defined the role of religion in a democracy. It's not an easy thing.
For many decades, Dr. Saeed M. Saeed has been at the forefront of some of the most ambitious and inspiring interreligious initiatives in this country and far beyond. A gifted speaker and bridge builder, Dr. Saeed has met with two popes and many leading rabbis, and now has just accepted his latest assignment as president of the Islamic Society of North America. This week, I look forward to welcoming him back to State of Belief Radio. But first,
I come from the civil rights era. Started with Dr. King in 1959. Pastored here in Atlanta for many years, and people said, why are you concerned about the environment now? Why don't you stay with civil and human rights? And I simply said, I cannot get to civil and human rights and talk about Trayvon Martin or anybody else if I'm dead from the toxic water and the air and the pollution that's all around. This, to me, is a civil rights issue of our time.
Earlier this month, California hosted a diverse gathering of scientists, activists, and concerned citizens for the 2018 Global Climate Action Summit. As more and more faith communities include climate issues in their ministry, religious voices were prominent at the summit. Among those groups, Interfaith Power and Light was prominent, not in small measure, because this coalition's brand new board chairman is longtime civil rights leader Gerald Durley. For a look at this critically important issue from a religious and social justice perspective, I'm very pleased to welcome the Reverend Dr. Durley to State of Belief Radio. Dr. Durley, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me to join you.
Would you describe the California Summit and how big a role are faith-inspired activist groups now playing on this issue?
The Global Climate Summit in California was one, I think, of significance and important because it was a follow-up to the Paris Agreement treaty that was held some time ago and other treaties that have been pulled together by countries and scientists all over the world. In California, it was basically championed by the governor, Jerry Brown, who was saying that this is a critical issue climate change, global warming, and, of course, environmental justice issues. To four, business and scientists and politicians have all been at the forefront of this effort. And now it is the belief that those of us in the faith community that we must become very much involved with this, because we believe, and I certainly believe, that this is a moral issue which we face, because it goes directly to the core of our mission as a faith people. We believe that God created a perfectly balanced ecological world, and that because we're placing profits over people, that we're destroying it. So therefore, if business people, scientists, and politicians are to make any major decisions about changing the catastrophes that we see occurring all around us, Katrina, Florence, Sandy, these hurricanes, then we must be at the table speaking about this. My personal conviction is that this is the civil and human rights issue of our time. I joined with Dr. King and Andy and all of us in 1960 when they when we were fighting for our constitutional rights merely to vote. Mm-hmm. And we said at that time, everybody has a right to vote. And now we're saying that everyone has a right to clean energy, toxic-free water, unpolluted an unpolluted environment. So that's why the connection between our being out there was so very important, that the faith began to take its role right now in this movement. And I believe that that's why California and Paris and the faith role is important. I do believe that it is now picking up steam, that more and more people across faith, Muslims, Buddhists, Shiites, Christians, that this is an interfaith effort. And God is bigger than any one of our one little small departments. So this is why I think it's significant, Reverend Getty.
The Trump administration has stepped away, far away from previous U.S. commitments regarding climate change. Were you encouraged by what you heard at the summit in San Francisco?
Yes, I was. I was encouraged whenever there's a saying in one of the traditions, the Christian tradition, that says where two or three are gathered together in my name. So it's not always a large gathering that makes a difference. So when one small administration that governs a major nation makes a pulling away from different agreements, that does not discourage me. But I am encouraged when I can see 29 philanthropic organizations coming together, 29, and pledging over $4 billion to begin to address the issue of climate change. That is encouraging. When I can see small groups and non-NGOs coming together to begin to really discuss the issues at the grassroots level. All major societies have always been changed when the people become aware of the conditions in which they're in. In the civil rights movement, we had three words that continue to give us strength: organize, strategize, and mobilize. And organization comes when there is a level of awareness. And California and the many people that were there were becoming aware of the marches that are around the world now, not just in America. That's given me a certain sense of hope that we are now beginning to understand that we must live up to the first commandment. The second, the Ten Commandments were fine, but the first commandment was, I'm going to give you a planet, I'm going to give you an earth that will give you everything that you need in terms of air and water and food. But we have unfortunately broken that commandment, and we're paying the consequences now. So when I see people coming together across business, political, faith lines in this moral battle, I am strongly encouraged, not for the next generation, but for this generation.
What's the role of faith-inspired organizations such as Interfaith Power and Light at this moment in history in terms of the climate crisis?
I feel that our role now, we're in 40 different states in 27 to 28 houses of faith. And when we come together, what we try to do is look at what are the practical ways in which people can begin to help. Unfortunately, this whole cataclysmic attitude of the climate, when you see major storms like we've just seen in North and South Carolina and other in the Philippines and around the world, we think it's too large for us to get a hold or handle of it. There's nothing that we can do. So the role of the faith community will be just small but major things in terms of sustaining of energy. Right now, the fight over water will be much more pronounced than the fight over oil, even in the Middle East. We look at in California where water is drying up. So we've got to protect the natural resources that we have even now. They are finite. We've got to hold the, there's a thing we call 1.5 Celsius down in terms of carbon dioxide in the air. We can prevent that when we pull away from fossil burning fuel and be looking at alternative energy such as solar, such as wind. So if we can get the clergy people, the spiritual leaders to begin to articulate that to their people in the various mosques and synagogues and temples and churches, congregation, then I think that awareness begins to increase not only in the mind but also in the actual what we do in terms of a lifestyle. We have become, let me use the word, comfortable and complacent. We'll walk out and leave all the lights burning, or we'll turn the heat all the way up, or we'll air condition the outside because our houses are not insulated. So these are things that we can do to sustain what we have now, and I think that we'll have a chance. And I believe that God, Allah, whoever, Jehovah, will become pleased to say now they are keeping the commandments, and now I will honor their actions. That's the role that Interfaith Power and Light that we're doing consistently by sending information, by recognizing days, that continuously organizing and bringing people to awareness. And that's the strategy. And now we're in the mobilization phase.
I'd like for you to tell our listeners about what Interfaith Power and Light is and how it came to be, the number of churches involved, and some of the initiatives that you're working on.
Interfaith Power and Light was initially conceived. That was a lady by the name, she was at Grace Cathedral in San Francisco by the name of Sally Bingham, and she was very much concerned about what was being done or not done to preserving the planet. And she started a group called Interfaith Power and Light, and California was the first group. Then she met other people. And one of the goals is one thing for, I believe, for us to sit and to pray. It's another thing for us to get involved from a legislative point of view, from a lobbying point of view. Interfaith Power and Light was started by Sally and certain other people, and now it's in 40 different states and about 22 to 28,000 different houses of faith. Primarily, even here in Louisiana, they're getting where I am now. Bruce Carroll is working on it in Alabama. There's another group. And Sally's pulling together local, because all politics are local. What are we doing in terms of encouraging our city council, our public service commissions, and our city governments to look at alternative methods in terms of the of solar, in terms of solar, wind, or other alternative energies in the city government, in terms of their buildings, from public service commissions? How are they legislating even what the power companies are doing? So Interfaith Power and Light is working along with those companies. In North Carolina, we're working with the hog farmers and what they're doing over there, working along with water keepers. And we work along with water keepers and Sierra Club and Wildlife and other NGOs. But we bring the moral force. Mm-hmm. We bring the spiritual effort to make this happen. That's not to say others are not morally concerned, but I believe prophets move a certain group of people in a capitalist society. So we're saying, fine, if we can convince you that you can make a profit through solar or through other alternative energy sources, if the automobile industry, who said that they could get cars driving at 52 miles to the gallon by certain years, then why would the current administration release those regulations? Yes, we're concerned about the current administration that's saying let's begin to drill again in the ocean, that climate change might be a hoax, that this is something that's just happening. That's that administration's position. But I believe that I've learned over the years, and with civil rights, human rights, and God rights, that that this administration is under a larger administration, and I work for the larger administration, and that administration will never be defeated. It will always win in the end. So Interfaith Power and Light is a part of the major administration challenging the minor administration, who's bringing wreaking a lot of havoc on so many of God's creations and creatures.
So for anyone who wants to get involved in the work of Interfaith Power and Light, what's the best way to do that?
Well, if they could just contact our office there in Interfaith Power and Light at 369 Pine Street in San Francisco, California. And I'm sorry, I don't have the phone number, but it's fairly easily accessible. And we have a new president, Susan Hendershot from Iowa. She was, we have, in each of these states, we have what we call affiliates. And she was an affiliate director. And now she is the new president. Sally has stepped down now. And all of any, we'll have an office there working in Washington and out of San Francisco. We'll try to be on the front line of most issues that are emerging or that have emerged to bring light on those and then give strategies to what it is that we can do. So it's just not about praying. I believe in prayer. I believe strongly in prayer, and I have a lot of faith, but I believe we add our action, that faith without works, as you know, Reverend Gaddy, is dead. So if we're going to stay alive, then we've got to combine our actions with our words, because I've often said our thoughts become our words, and our words become our behavior, and our behavior becomes our actions, and our actions become our habits, and our habits become our destiny. And we believe that our destiny now is to try to protect the beautiful, perfectly balanced world, that God, ecological balanced world that God has given us. That's what Interfaith Power and Light is about. And as a new chair, I'll just be working along with others who are much smarter than me, much more knowledgeable than me, but trying to encourage people to let's come together and make a difference.
Reverend Dr. Gerald Durley is the new board chair at Interfaith Power and Light. A civil rights and interfaith activist for decades, Dr. Durley is much in demand as a speaker and educator. His autobiography is titled, I Am Amazed. Dr. Durley, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Anytime that we can be of help to you, you need to let us know that.
Anything I can do, please give me a call.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. We'll hear from the legendary interfaith activist, Dr. Saeed M. Saeed, the brand new president of ISNA, the Islamic Society of North America. And up next, the latest political disinformation in textbooks in Texas and beyond. We'll hear about the hashtag Teach the Truth campaign from the Texas Freedom Network's Dan Quinn. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. It's bad enough that the great state of Texas seems to have a uniquely partisan way of vetting school textbooks. But then, because of its sheer size, Texas-approved textbooks tend to end up in the classrooms of a number of other states as well. The latest round of revisionism has been making headlines recently, and our friends at the Texas Freedom Network have responded with the hashtag Teach the Truth campaign. With details, I'm joined by TFN Communications Director Dan Quinn. Dan, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Well, thanks for having me.
We've addressed some of the more extreme instances of misinformation that was headed for the pages of Texas textbooks. Mm-hmm. The Moses matter comes to mind, for example. Would you briefly review the history of this question?
Sure. So back in 2010, the State Board of Education here revised the social studies curriculum standards for all of our public schools. And as you remember, it was a circus. I mean, the board there was heavily dominated by social conservatives. They pushed through a number of changes to the standards that even conservative reviewers, at, say the Thomas Fordham Institute, called it a politicized distortion of history. And it was. And one of the things they pushed really hard on was to suggest to students that this is a Christian nation, and that there is that separation of church and state isn't a key constitutional principle protecting religious freedom in this country. So here we are 8 years later. They're streamlining the standards because teachers have been telling them you have too much stuff in here and it's too hard to teach and some of it's not even true. So the board's trying to cut back on that, and they asked teachers and scholars to come together and and figure out a way to shorten the standards and take out some of the stuff. Well, we've been arguing you can streamline the standards the best by just taking out the junk history. But unfortunately, when the teams did that last week, the board came back, social conservatives, and put a lot of that stuff back in there. Moses was one of them.
Do they know that Moses was not a Christian?
You have to wonder at some point. But the strange thing about it is, you know, obviously Moses is an important biblical figure to Jews and Christians. And students should learn about the profound influence that religions have in this country. I mean, that's just an actual historical fact. But we don't need to make things up.
Right.
And that's really what the board has been doing. They've now listed Moses as somebody whose principles of government were a major influence on the founders in writing our founding documents. What in the world are they talking about? religious scholars actually came before them last week and said this is just simply not true at all. But the board just said, well, we don't agree and we're going to do it anyway. And that's, of course, what they did.
So, Dan, what is it in the process in Texas that makes it so easy to manipulate truth?
Well, the problem is when politicians get involved in writing curriculum standards for kids, then history is determined by majority vote instead of listening to scholars and teachers who can tell these folks, you know, this is what's actually historically true and what students should be learning in their public school classrooms. What's happened in Texas is we've politicized what kids learn in their public schools simply because the politicians who get elected to the State Board of Education have the authority to do it, just simply by majority vote, and there doesn't seem to be much anybody can do about that unless the legislature were to take their authority away, and that doesn't seem to be likely in the Texas legislature we have right now.
Would you talk about the kinds of individuals who've been selected and equally notable, those who have been rejected from participating on curriculum committees?
Yeah, so we have to say the curriculum committees that were appointed this year were filled by a lot of great people. They got some really good teachers, curriculum specialists, scholars who sat down, put a lot of serious work into this, pulled a lot of the nonsense, a lot of the junk history out. And then the board just reversed a lot of their decisions. In the past, we've had a lot more problems with those teams. State board members would nominate political activists who had no training at all in the social studies or in history or science or whatever the other subjects were that they were working on. But their political ideology, their worldview, aligned with the board members who appointed them to the teams.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would have to fight over and over again. When we would see the nonsense they were pushing into the standards, we'd be asking the board to take it out. In this case, the professionals that were on the teams actually said, we need to take this stuff out. And the board came back and said, no, we're going to put it back in.
Hmm. Dan, talk about some of the legendary pieces of misinformation that tried to make their way into textbooks in Texas and beyond.
The textbook wars in Texas go a long ways back. The state board here, you know, they set the curriculum standards, and then publishers write their textbooks to meet those standards. And, of course, the state's so big that they basically write their textbooks for this state and then sell the same books to schools across the country. Over the years, the battles have been everything from sex education to what students learn about evolution in their science classrooms to whether or not students are going to learn the truth about slavery and the Civil War, to whether Moses was a major influence on the founding of the United States. You know, and we've had fights over a photograph of a woman carrying a briefcase in a health textbook that social conservatives claimed was presenting the wrong role model for students when it came to the role of women in families. You know, they shouldn't be going off to work. They wanted a picture of her instead baking a cake in the oven. They didn't want any information in health textbooks about birth control. God forbid students should learn anything about protecting their sexual health.
Mm-hmm.
They've attacked the teaching of evolution, trying to insert creationist arguments suggesting that evolution isn't established science. On social studies, they've during the 2010 debate, they argued that slavery was just a side issue in causing the Civil War and that the real issue causing the Civil War was states' rights, Well, that's a historical lie mm-hmm. that Southern apologists have been using for a century and a half, and that, frankly, generations of Southern kids have been learning in their schools. We had scholars who were standing before them last week saying that this is just simply not true. The states' rights argument is a myth. It's worse than that. White supremacists have used that same argument to slow down and stop progress on civil rights in this country for a century and a half. The last thing we should be doing is echoing those arguments in our textbooks, but that's what we're doing. And the state board last week said we're going to keep doing it.
How far back does this go?
It goes back quite a ways. Back in the 1960s, Mel and Norma Gabler, a couple in East Texas, started this effort to censor textbooks, and they got a lot of attention. They'd roll out long lists of errors they claimed were in the textbooks. Often these were just ideological objections to content. They got a lot of coverage on 2020, national press about how the textbooks here were wrong. But really it was an effort for them to strike information from textbooks that they had ideological objections to. And that was in the 60s. And they began to train other social conservatives of how to do this. And then in the late 80s, early the 1990s, they began a concerted effort to take over the State Board of Education in Texas. They found a well-heeled funder to pay for their campaigns and slowly built up control of the State Board until they essentially took control of it around 2006. They were very powerful up to that point, but after 2006, they pretty much controlled the board. And that's when we had big battles over the teaching of evolution. We had big battles over these social studies standards. So this has really a long history in Texas. And again, what happens in Texas doesn't stay in Texas when it comes mm-hmm. to textbooks.
Yeah.
So what you get here, you're going to get in the rest of the country at some point.
Dan, is this politics, ignorance? What is it?
I think it's mostly ideology. It's the product of what you get when you allow politicians so much authority to determine what kids learn in their classrooms, instead of listening to scholars and teachers say, this is really truth, this is the facts, these are the facts, and this is what students need to know to get a good education and be successful later on in life, and be informed citizens making decisions when they go into the ballot box and when they work on public policy issues and they go before their local school boards and city councils. But politicians bring to boards like this, and Texas isn't the only one with a state board, they bring their political perspectives, their worldviews to this. And at some point, education just becomes a subject of, becomes determined essentially by whichever political majority controls the board. The facts are no longer facts. The facts are the opinions of the politicians who make the decisions.
You have the campaign, the hashtag Teach the Truth. Talk about that, please.
Folks can see the campaign at tfn.org/teachthetruth. There's a petition on there. There's a report that we released in February. We consulted with scholars around the country to help us with that, with recommendations about how the state board could fix these standards and teach the truth instead of teaching politicized junk history in our classrooms. But I think you're right. This isn't just happening in Texas. There's a crisis of, there's a crisis of faith. There's a crisis of faith in facts,
mm-hmm.
Both in Texas and across the country right now. This belief that if you disagree with something, it has to be factually incorrect, no matter what the evidence says about it. We see that from the White House to the State House to the State Board of Education in Texas, and we've got to figure out a way to get around that. And I think part of it's voting. People just got to get out and vote. Maybe that will make some changes, mm-hmm. but we've got to figure out a way to get past this crisis of faith and facts.
Dan Quinn is Communications Director at the Texas Freedom Network. Thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you for having me. Y'all take care.
Dr. Saeed M. Saeed has for decades been the best friend interfaith cooperation and understanding could ever have. And thankfully, he's also been a longtime personal friend to me. To a long resume of leadership positions, Dr. Saeed has just added the title of President of ISNA, the Islamic Society of North America, where he previously served as National Director for the Office for Interfaith and Community Alliances. At a time when divisions seem to keep growing deeper, I am delighted to welcome him back to our program. Saeed, thank you so much for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. This is an honor indeed.
You know, there is so much turmoil in our world today, and so much of it seems to involve differences of beliefs and convictions. Honestly, I constantly find myself thinking about you and your boundless commitment to building bridges and partnerships. What are your thoughts to the ways Americans seem to be more and more separated from each other?
Well, that is a challenge, there's no doubt, because we have to be a connected nation. This is an experiment in human pluralism, diversity. Our country is committed. It started with this commitment of creating a society that is multiracial, multireligious, multisectarian. So the common thread among all of us is we recognize dignity in the other. And if we fail in that, then there is nothing that can salvage us.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why all of us have to make our contribution, our effort to reinforce that kind of vision that is very uniquely American.
Mm-hmm. Saeed, do you believe that things have really changed in the past couple of years?
Yeah. I mean, both sides. You know that you remember in after 9/11, these terrorists used to say something in the caves of Afghanistan, and their statements would go as the headlines, as if they were representing our religion. Similarly, today also, megaphone is in the hands of people in America particularly who are giving statements and making claims which are based on total fake news and undoing of what our generations in America have been able to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a concern, but I am personally confident that all this fake news and fake statements and distortion of the commitment towards respect for diversity, it's only on the superficial. Because ultimately, we as human beings, we as citizens of the world, are guided by the basic principle of living and letting others live.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why there's a bigger responsibility on us to undo what we are watching for the last several years.
How would you counsel people who are tired of and wounded by the contentious tone of our private and public rhetoric to make a positive contribution?
I mean, we have, as religious leaders, we have to emphasize that it is our own duty to first reinforce our commitment towards this healthy, constructive vision, and then to mobilize our contacts, our communities in that direction. We have a saying in the Quran, a verse in the Quran, in Allah la yughayyiru ma biqawmin, that God does not change the destiny of a nation unless the people themselves change their own selves. So religiously, as religious leaders, we believe that it is, on the one hand, individual responsibility for us. Where we see there is a direction which is leading towards injustice and discrimination, we need to stand up. I mean, you have been here in Washington, D.C. You have spent your decades and decades fighting these battles. So it's a constant struggle. It cannot end. I mean, you know that Muslims and Christians, we believe the coming of Jesus Christ as a savior, as a reformer, as a peace builder. And Jews also, and all other religions have a similar kind of notion that there will be someone who will come and represent truth and justice. And that's amazing. Basically, it's an idea. It's a belief that all of us together have to promote and work for advancing the cause of justice, social justice, justice in every sense, and peace, so that we create a world which befits our this whole belief of someone who will be the prince of peace and prince of spirituality. So we'll continue doing that, and we will never give up, and nobody should give up, because that is against the fundamental belief of religion. One who opens one's heart and mind to despondency, it is suicidal in that sense, and suicide, no religion has ever pardoned that.
Isn't it true that if we get people crossing lines of faith, we help get rid of the divisions?
Well, as you know that, fundamentally, at the foundation of each faith, there is a commitment for peace and justice. You don't have to change your affiliation. You don't have to cross boundaries in that sense. But certainly, you have to cross boundaries, the boundaries that have been imposed on us by advocates of racial advocates, advocates of extremism, advocates of misdirected and misinterpreted religious boundaries. Mm-hmm. Those boundaries will ultimately disappear because they are not there, because there is so much common among all of us in terms of advocating peace and justice. So in a world, in a global world, in a world where there is so much quick communication, we will see more and more like-minded people coming forward and mm-hmm. taking the mantle.
Tell me what you will be doing, and if there is a singular goal in your mind, tell us that.
Well, you know that we are celebrating 55th anniversary of Islamic Society of North America. Mm-hmm. I have been one of the founders. I have been active with it for the last 50 years. I have served as its chief executive. I have served as national director here on the Capitol Hill. This organization, Islamic organization, has a very unique character, a unique feature in history. For the last 55 years, after every 2 years, we have held elections. It's a democratic organization. We have elected chief, that is the president of this organization, from the Muslim community, who are Shia, who are Sunni, who are women, who are men. So in that sense, you have to understand that this is the only Islamic organization in the world that has internalized the democratic spirit and the democratic system. No other Islamic organization in the world has 50 years, half a century of history are being democratic. No Muslim country in the world, you know that there are about 57 countries which are called Muslim countries because they are Muslim majority or they are members of the Organization of Islamic Conference. None of them has had a history of half a century with democracy, with equal participation of different ethnicities and different genders and so on. So therefore, that gives us a very unique opportunity to reach out to members of the Muslim community of different backgrounds and different origins. So my commitment is to reinforce that character, that is to bring in or to widen our impact to all different these members of the Muslim community. We have been in the past building Islamic centers, training imams, and helping them to understand what it means to live in a democracy, why is religious freedom an asset for us? It is not against us. It is in our favor. Because religious freedom in many of the Muslim countries is not available there. But we want to make it an Islamic principle, because Quran tells us, La ikraha fid din, there should be no compulsion in religion. People should have freedom. So we have grown, we have prospered in America, because America has guaranteed religious freedom for us as Muslims. So Islam wants to guarantee similar freedom in for non-Muslims, you know, living as minorities in the Muslim country. So this is very critical. I want to make sure that we exchange delegations, we exchange our scholars, so that the Muslim scholars in the Muslim world, they understand that this is central to Islam.
You know,
similarly, yeah.
Well, no, I was just going to interrupt you to say, you are the person to do that. You and I have talked long hours about the importance of democracy, and I've listened to your stories about the struggle that you had in introducing democracy to the organization and to people that you work with, and you have done that superbly. So if you do that in this office that you're in now, you're going to make a great contribution to the United States, to democracy, and to the Muslim faith, in my opinion.
But I cannot do these things by myself. I mean, I have a large number of Muslim scholars, community leaders who share my views, with whom I associate, and who are ready to do things that we need to do. But yes, at the same time, friends like you have been a source of support and source of guidance in that sense. So I am proud that I have equally a good number of friends from different other faith origin. So you recollect how you were leading one of those great things. We have this shoulder-to-shoulder with American Muslims fighting against Islamophobia. This is such a unique thing that Christians, Jews, Christians of different denominations got together and formed this shoulder-to-shoulder with American Muslims. And it is, I mean, led and steered by Christians and Jews, funded by Christians and Jews. And we need to strengthen that kind of approach, that kind of attitude.
Right.
Because that's a role model. We want to see that happen around the world. You will be happy to know that Finland already started shoulder to shoulder with Finnish Muslims. And it is happening in Scandinavian countries. And I'm sure that this is a formula. This will spread in other countries as well.
Saeed, I know you have focused on interfaith work all your adult life, but I also know that this work has been informed by your Muslim faith. Would you talk for just a moment about that for us to hear? What does Islam give you that helps you do what you do across different faith traditions?
I mean, you know, Islam itself is actually an interfaith religion, because Islam is considered a religion that recognizes not Prophet Muhammad, who usually people think is the founder of Islam, but it becomes a requirement for a faithful Muslim to have equally full faith and respect to the long line of other prophets and religions who have taught the same thing: monotheism, oneness of God, oneness of human family, and oneness of the message, that is, human beings are from the same family, whatever our color, whatever our physiological and other differences may be, but fundamentally we are the creation of same divine, and then we originally come from our one father and mother, Adam and Eve. And these things are repeated so many times in the Quran to reinforce that kind of vision in a believer, in a Muslim who believes in Islam, who believes in Quran. These names are repeated in the Bible and repeated again in the Quran. So Quran in that sense is not alien. You will be very happy to see that we have published the translation of the Quran, mm-hmm, verse by verse into English. And verse by verse, you will see at the footnotes corresponding verses from the Bible. How much is common? So there is more common than many people think. But then it is this commonness that can reinforce a shared vision. It's unfortunate that there are people who are more motivated to create barriers, to promote hatred and discrimination, but we have to be steadfast in our beliefs and our agenda, the agenda that is for a healthy and Muslim community and an American nation in that sense.
Saeed M. Saeed is a lifelong interfaith activist and leader who has just accepted the position of President of the Islamic Society of North America, where he previously held the title of National Director for the Office for Interfaith and Community Alliances. In 2010, Interfaith Alliance honored Dr. Saeed with the President's Award at the Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards ceremony. Saeed, I know full well the power to inspire and to organize that you bring to this new position. And it is a critical time for you to do so. You are the person to do it. Thank you for being with us today. And just know we're going to call you again to hear how it's going.
Thank you very much. We need your prayers. We need your support. It is not an easy task.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you think there's value in the conversations we present and the voices we amplify in the midst of the gridlock our public rhetoric too often becomes, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.